Welcome to Voices of Change, a podcast for the Get the Medications Right Institute. We are on the cusp of a new era of specialty medications and gene therapies that will transform care, but we also see tremendous waste. Every year, more than $528 billion is wasted, and more than 275,000 lives are lost due to non-optimized medication use. Misuse, overuse, or underuse of medication therapy can lead to treatment failure, a new medical problem, or both. Consider that 1 in 10 Americans take 5 or more prescription drugs. More than 75% of all physician office visits result in a prescription for medication. More than 4 billion prescriptions are filled each year in U.S. pharmacies. And 50 to 75% of patients don't take their medications as directed. But there is good news. There are ways to control the loss and waste, whether you are involved in receiving, paying for, or delivering care. Living in a world where patients get the right medications the first time is attainable. That's what we're doing at the Get the Medications Right Institute, and that's what you'll hear about on Voices of Change. Here's your host for Voices of Change, the Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Institute, Katie Capps.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us today. Speaking with us on this episode of Voices of Change is Liz Fowler, Executive Vice President for Programs at the Commonwealth Fund. Liz is former Vice President for Global Health Policy at Johnson & Johnson and former Special Assistant to President Barack Obama on Healthcare and Economic Policy at the National Economic Council. Liz has also occupied key positions at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, where she assisted with implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Prior to her work in the administration, Ms. Fowler was the chief health counsel to former Senate Finance Committee Chair, Senator Matt Baucus. She served as Vice President of Public Policy and External Affairs for WellPoint, now Anthem, and as an attorney with the Washington law firm from Hogan and Hartson. She also spent 5 years as a health service researcher with Park Nicolet Foundation in Minnesota. Recently, Ms. Fowler was a keynote speaker at our February 6th event at the Bipartisan Policy Center, where she delivered remarks on public policy and medication management reform. She shared her views of comprehensive medication management, or CMM. Incorporating her remarks from the February event, she wrote the foreword for a recently released Blueprint for Change, which we hope will serve as a guide to reform, to revamp our medication use process by changing how we practice, how we pay, how we use diagnostics, and how we integrate technology. Welcome to our show, Liz.
Thanks, Katie. Thanks a lot for having me on. And boy, February sure feels like a long time ago. It's only August, but February, given everything we've been through since then, feels like a year ago.
An eternity away, and we certainly don't have the pleasure or the benefits of face-to-face meetings as we have in the past. So you're right. This will go on record, I think, as our longest year. So, Liz, as a leading health policy expert in both the public and the private sectors, you've got a very extensive background and clearly a passion for health policy. Can you elaborate more on how you got into this work, and then tell us a little more about your work with the Commonwealth Fund?
Sure. Thanks, Katie. And I guess I've always been interested in health policy, or healthcare anyway. I thought I wanted to be a physician like my dad and my grandfather. But in college, I took a class and learned that the U.S. was the only developed country in the world without a national health system. And that seemed more interesting. I'm sure practicing medicine is just as interesting, but for some reason, the policy world attracted me at a really young age. So I've been at it for a while, and like you said, my career has taken a lot of twists and turns from the public sector on the finance committee to the private sector and the plan world and back to the public sector and then back to the private sector. So I've had a lot of great opportunities to work on major health legislation and implementation of major health policy. And now I'm leading programs at the Commonwealth Fund, which is a private Foundation, founded in 1918, whose mission is to promote a high-performing health system. We define a high-performing health system as one that provides universal coverage and affordable health care for all, delivers high-value care, promotes health equity, and achieves long-term sustainable health spending for public payers as well as private payers. We support independent research, data analysis, survey research, and through an examination of international experiences. Our grant making is modest compared to other larger foundations. We give out about $25 million each year, but I like to think we have an outsized impact because of our deep subject matter experts in their respective program areas and the thoughtful approach we take to anticipating future needs of policymakers and health system leaders. Just a couple of highlights from our recent work in the area of healthcare coverage. We're working with the Urban Institute to model different approaches to achieving universal coverage.
Just a note, the Urban Institute is a nonprofit research organization that seeks to improve public policy and practice, strengthen communities, and transform lives by identifying current challenges and looking ahead to identify opportunities for change. Let's get back to Liz.
We put out a report last fall that showed how you could achieve universal coverage or expand coverage from everything from tinkering with the ACA to going full on Medicare for all. And we're delving a little deeper into some of those policies, looking more closely at public option, for example. In the area of cost containment, we're looking at Medicare solvency and evaluating competition in hospital and pharmaceutical markets. Our state health policy team is looking at state strategies for addressing cost containment. In the area of physician and payment and delivery system reform, we have a delivery system reform task force that's set to make recommendations coming out in November, just after the election. In international health policy, we put out a survey last week, and I'm happy to talk more about that, but comparing mental and economic stress of COVID across different countries. And then health equity. We've recently made a commitment to dedicate $15 million over 3 years to advance health equity and eliminate racial disparities in healthcare. So a lot going on and a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. I'm most familiar with the Commonwealth Fund and the work that they've done in the primary care space, long a champion of primary care. And I think the recognition of the value and importance of primary care. So I'm curious, I don't know if you can share this with our listeners, but on the task force around delivery system transformation, can you give us any insight into activities around that as it relates to primary care, Liz, or should we wait until November to gain more insight into that?
The task force just mentioned is the Commonwealth Fund Task Force on the Future of Payment and Delivery System Reform. It was created in May 2019 to examine and analyze what we've learned from decades of pilot programs and experimental efforts to improve healthcare delivery, and then to incorporate evidence and expert opinions into recommendations that will improve how healthcare is organized, structured, and paid for. These recommendations will be released later this year. Now, let's continue.
Probably wait until November. I don't want to spill the beans too soon, but there is a whole section on primary care. And let me tell you, we're looking at six strategies for improving payment and delivery systems in the U.S. The first is now we've added, as a result of COVID, looking at how we can increase our preparedness for future health disasters. We have another strategy related to accountability for quality, equity, and cost of care. The third strategy is specifically calling out primary care and the need to shore up our primary healthcare system. We have a section on empowerment and engagement of people, communities, and families, strategy around administrative burden and cost containment, and then looking at regulatory and competitive approaches to promoting a high-performing health system. But we have of outside experts who are advising us and part of the task force. So look forward to sharing more in the future, Katie.
That's terrific. We'd love to get you back and talk to you about that. I think that'll be a much anticipated report. So I know you're seeing firsthand a lot of policy concerns in the current and very quickly changing healthcare landscape as a result of COVID-19. We are certainly all feeling that. All of us in the healthcare industry are feeling that. What do you see, Liz, as the three most important prominent areas where we need to rethink current policy?
Well, that's a great question, and I think everyone's trying to come up with an answer for that question lately, and might point some of your readers to an article that my boss, David Blumenthal, just published in the New England Journal a couple of weeks ago, and that I co-authored along with a couple of my colleagues, specifically looking at COVID-19 and the implications to our healthcare system. So point you to that.
You can find the article mentioned here on the New England Journal of Medicine's website. The article is titled COVID-19, Implications for the Healthcare System, and it's by David Blumenthal, Elizabeth Fowler, Melinda Abrams, and Sarah Collins. The authors delve into the current healthcare environment and its failures in response to the pandemic, as well as opportunities to improve the system through our response. Let's listen.
But just to add my perspective on your question, I think the first would be pandemic preparedness. I think it goes without saying that how the country that was judged by Johns Hopkins, their Center for Health Security, as the best prepared out of 195 countries to combat a global pandemic back in October could end up being the country with the most confirmed cases and among the top five in terms of per capita death as a result of COVID really bears further study and a deep reflection of what we can do better and differently next time. That really should be a top priority for Congress and the next administration once we get past how to address the current public health and economic crisis. I think second, and I mentioned health equity, the huge disparities between communities of color, particularly Blacks and Hispanics, compared to whites in terms of rates of COVID infections and cases and deaths, I think really bears a look at ways of doing things differently and policies to address these disparities. And I think that's closely tied to coverage. I think COVID has exposed the need to consider Medicaid expansion. We're now down to 12 states that haven't expanded Medicaid after Oklahoma and last week Missouri voted to expand Medicaid. But it also brings into question the role of employers and our reliance on employer health coverage in light of so many people losing their jobs and source of income. And maybe I'll add one more if you'll indulge me, and that's the financial health of our providers. We are a system that relies most heavily on fee-for-service, and that system did not prepare us for such a dramatic drop in the demand for healthcare services. And I think a lot of providers, and particularly rural and small primary care practices, are really hurting right now and suffering huge financial losses. You know, Congress tried to restore and address some of those losses in the CARES Act, but the way that we've distributed those funds didn't always go to those most in need. And so I really think we need to rethink fee-for-service and think about capitation and value-based payment models in a new and more urgent light.
Yeah, we've had a lot of discussions. The GPMRX board recently had a lot of discussions around this with some of those in organized primary care, and a great deal of concern as well, because we know a high-performing health system requires that we have a strong and viable primary care network or primary care system. So to a large degree, the financial, you know, not only the distribution of the funds, but the financial strain that many of the primary care practices find themselves faced with, I think is creating a real crisis in local communities and rural communities. Expanding on your comment as it relates to reconsidering how we might finance primary care. I know there's been a lot of discussion around global payments moving from fee-for-service, and as we move forward as a nation and in a position of confronting these types of situations, have you as an organization outlined certain payment methodologies outside of the broad payment methodologies that you mentioned?
So I think we'll touch on that a bit in our delivery system reform task force recommendations, and we have been giving it some thought. I don't know that we've laid out a comprehensive alternative approach, but global payments and alternative payment methods are absolutely part of the way to address what we see as a huge shortcoming in our current system.
Right. And And of course, I think we all recognize and acknowledge more so now than we have in the past because it was a slow erosion. But for all intent and purposes, we've eviscerated our public health system. So, you know, that's been very difficult. And as you mentioned, our pandemic preparedness or lack therein also points to activities around our public health system. I would be interested in your insight as it relates to that as well.
Yeah, I think we have underfunded public health. And I think even going back to the Affordable Care Act, which tried to set aside funding for shoring up a public health system and training new personnel to address a pandemic, I'm not sure we, even with that funding, some of that funding ended up going towards existing priorities or backfilling areas where there had been cuts. So, you know, there's probably a lot of examination that needs to take place. And again, what could we do differently in the future?
So, as you mentioned, the pandemic has illuminated fractures in our current health system that we have to address immediately so we're better prepared for future public health crises. At the Commonwealth Fund, I think you guys have also been looking not only at the immediate challenges as we await broad access to a vaccine, which, you know, at the Institute, we consider the vaccine a product or, you know, how we might look at distribution of a product. But there are other unintended consequences like the rise in mental health issues. You mentioned the lack of coverage as a result of mass unemployment, and the enormous economic and practice impact on primary care. Do you think, Liz, that these issues will have longer lasting impact once we have broad availability of a vaccine? And how will we need to address the longer lasting impact on our delivery system as we move forward?
Well, first I'll just highlight a report that the Commonwealth Fund put out last week comparing 9 high-income countries, and the issue brief compares health and economic consequences of COVID across these countries. And the U.S., I guess maybe not surprisingly, had the highest rate of mental health concerns, stress or anxiety or sadness that was difficult to cope with as a result of the outbreak, almost 1 in 3. Compared to other countries that were much lower. But we also reported more trouble getting care when we had those mental health issues and wanted to seek care, as well as negative consequences stemming from COVID from economic consequences. So almost 1 in 3 adults reported difficulty paying for food, rent, and utilities. And we were also the highest and most likely to lose a job or a source of income. And I think all of these issues are going to have longer lasting implications. I think there's growing economic disparity between the haves and the have-nots is just going to be exacerbated. And I think there are implications for our healthcare system in that, in terms of affordability for paying for healthcare, in terms of delivery systems that provide care to these populations that may have difficulty paying for services. And I see that getting worse before it gets better. Not sure if that fully answered your question.
Here, Katie and Liz both mention a report published by the Commonwealth Fund on August 6, 2020, called Do Americans Face Greater Mental Health and Economic Consequences from COVID-19? Comparing the U.S. with Other High-Income Countries. The report highlights some of the consequences stemming from the pandemic. This research showed that Americans were more likely to have lost a job or source of income, have economic concerns, have a less favorable view of the government's response, and are more likely to have mental health concerns and need mental health care. Liz and Katie will talk more about these challenges and others, as well as the possible longer-term consequences. Let's listen.
You mentioned earlier, Liz, that you know, in the U.S., of course, we know that health insurance coverage for workers is closely tied to their employment status because we have an employer-supported health insurance for about 40, I don't know what the number is today, but I know it we were hovering around 47 to 50%.
Yep.
So
yep.
I'm assuming that those 9 high-income countries that you mentioned, there were also huge differences as it relates to the percentage of coverage that for individuals that receive that because of the varying approaches that they take to coverage for working individuals, correct? I mean, is there anything you'd like to highlight in that? I think that might be of interest to our listeners.
Every 3 years, I think next year we'll put out a new one, report comparing coverage, access, affordability, and value, quality of care across other developed countries. And, you know, most countries don't rely on employers to provide health coverage. That, you know, there are a couple of exceptions like Germany, but they all achieve universal health coverage, and that's something that we still haven't been able to achieve even after the Affordable Care Act. So we still have about 30 million uninsured people in this country who lack access to care. And even though Congress and the administration has tried to make access to COVID testing and treatment more widely available, the fact that we still have such a huge number of people without health insurance or health coverage, I think is really a travesty. And I think COVID hopefully will maybe give us the kick in the pants that we need to go ahead and cover the rest of the population. We started in 1965 with Medicare and Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Act or program in 1997, the Affordable Care Act that added 20 million more people to the rolls, but we still have a ways to go, and we need to get there.
Right, and I think this pandemic has certainly held up a mirror to that, and you know, those tied to coverage from an employer standpoint with the high unemployment numbers that we have. So as you know, at the Institute, we're calling, I'm going to change the subject just a little bit, but it ties into this, because if you consider that 80% of the way we treat and manage illness is through medications, you know and are very familiar that at the Institute, we're calling for medication management reform. We recognize that we need a better way at the practice level to manage and evaluate drugs to ensure appropriate use. So at the Institute, we're advocating for a reform that requires changing how we practice care, changing how we use diagnostics so we can ensure that we target the correct therapies, changing how we use health information technology so we can ensure at the point of care there is the right information for that team to make a decision about whether the patient has achieved clinical goals of therapy and or what their clinical condition is. And then changes in how we pay for care. So as you mentioned before, you know, the importance of ensuring that there are changed and appropriate payment systems in place. Given your policy background, Liz, and the current environment and the weaknesses that have shown themselves in the current environment, what's your advice to our listeners about how to most effectively bring about change in our medication use process?
Well, we had a lot of discussion about this at your conference in February, and I know your report touches on this also. But, you know, what we talked about in February was that we're going to soon have a debate about cost containment in our healthcare system in the near future. And I think COVID has changed that dynamic a little bit, but it hasn't eliminated the need to have this conversation. So earlier this year, the Medicare trustees said that they thought our Medicare trust fund would go insolvent in 2026, but they also cautioned that that doesn't include the impact of COVID. Some estimates think it could be as soon as 2023, and that's going to really bring the need and necessitate some real serious thinking about dramatic policies to address shortfalls in funding for Medicare. You know, the recent executive order looking at rescinding payroll tax can make this problem even worse. And the reason I think that COVID has changed this dynamic is because, you know, when Congress goes to address Medicare solvency, they look at hospital cuts, across-the-board cuts. That's really hard to do when you have a lot of hospitals that are really suffering and trying to cope with the impact of COVID and the decline in volume and revenue. And I think comprehensive medication management can play a role. It can be part of the solution. And I think that's going to be even more important given what we've experienced over the last, I guess, 5 months now, going on 6.
Coming up, Katie and Liz discuss the recent Get the Medications Right Institute call for medication management reform. The way we currently manage medication therapy is not working. There are too many instances where medications make people sick, are wrong, or are skipped. The Institute advocates for a more integrated, team-based approach to prevent these problems called Comprehensive Medication Management, or CMM. It involves a clinical pharmacist working in collaborative practice with a physician and a care team to assess the patient's total medication picture and to confirm each medication is appropriate for the patient, effective for the medical condition, safe given the comorbidities and other medications being taken, and able to be taken by the patient as intended. Let's get back to Liz.
But CMM should be part of the solution. It should be on the table, as we talked about back in February. And it, I think, should play an even greater role in our thinking about how to improve care and improve quality and lower costs in a way that doesn't undermine the financial viability of our system as a whole. So I think there's even more a need for this discussion.
Right, and as you know, the delivery of CMM as a care process is very intertwined with support for team-based care and support for that team as part of a collaborative practice, specifically in primary care. So I think that we certainly as an organization and as an institute recognize that not only does payment need to change, but also the recognition of those team members that are working collaboratively with primary care physician or specialist in whatever setting that there may be. Liz, did you want to offer any closing remarks? If you were to look in your crystal ball, where do you see us as a nation 6 months from now as it relates to health policy?
Well, as it relates to health policy, I mean, you know, I don't want to be a doom and gloom, so I don't want to say these problems are so difficult and we don't seem to be able to resolve them. So let's try to be on looking on the bright side. I'd like to think that we as a nation are able to look back and recognize what went wrong in COVID on the pandemic preparedness and the public health side, in the delivery system side, and coverage and equity and all of the issues we talked about already, and come up with some sort of consensus or path forward, that we're able to get over the huge hurdle and gap in our partisan differences and come together as a country and really find solutions. I have to say I'm a little pessimistic now, just given everything that's transpired and the inability of our current leadership in finding a path forward, even to addressing some of the real needs that people have right now, extending unemployment and people that are going to lose housing and being able to protect those that are really most at risk in this very vulnerable time. So I'm feeling pessimistic as I look at our current landscape, but would like to think maybe there's a way forward that is more positive and more, I guess, collaborative.
Well, And you know, at the Institute, we believe that action changes things, and we are committed to moving forward with those organizations that are interested and ready to take action to ensure that we have a safe medication use process and that there is appropriate use of medication, and it interrelates absolutely into a viable and accessible healthcare system. So I want to thank you, Liz, for taking the time to speak with us today. I could speak with you another hour. Unfortunately, time does not allow, and I'm not sure that there won't be another opportunity as we move down the road to discuss, I think, what your new report that's coming out on delivery system reform. So your insight, your perspectives, as always, are very enlightening and fresh. I want to offer a big thank you for your support, not only in joining us today, but also joining us in our important work at our February meeting.
Thank you, Katie. And Get the Medications Right has done so much work to push these issues to the forefront, and what you're doing is really important and absolutely should be a part of the conversation and part of whatever policymaking we do in the future.
That marks the end of this episode of Voices of Change. Thank you for tuning in. To learn more about what you can do to help get the medications right and to download our latest report, The Blueprint for Change, please visit us at www.gtmr.org. Until next time, be well.